Okay, let me just start the introduction to the introduction, and just say that the current talk is co-sponsored by the New York Immigration Seminar, which is led by the inimitable Van Tran and Nancy Foner, and the Advanced Research Collaboratives ARC weekly seminar series. And I want to say this particularly because if people are interested in applying for ARC fellowships, you have one more week to our extended deadline. So please, if you've been considering this or even considering it, do get in touch with me if you have any questions. And we'll be taking applications until next week. This is applies to both non-CUNY people non-CUNY faculty, for whom the ARC seminar will guarantee you a spacious office in Midtown, which hopefully by next year we will actually have access to, as well as the pleasure of our company and the honor of the affiliation. However, CUNY faculty get a semester off from teaching, which in the present economic circumstances is going to be probably a difficult thing to obtain. So we're very, very, very pleased about that. And you can find out more about the seminar and applications to it through our website, which if you go to the Graduate Center website and do drop down menu, it's under Advanced Research Collaborative. So that's my ad for the day. And I'm very, very pleased that we have today, this is something that we started to do this year, actually, to kind of celebrate what ARC has achieved, is to, in addition to having seminars, presentations by the people who are in residence at any given time, to also have book talks by ARC alums featuring work that was completed all or in part while they were on an ARC seminar. So it's kind of, this is what we achieved by all of this. We actually have work products. This is a particularly cool event for us in that in addition to the fact that Margaret has completed this fabulous book, which you'll be hearing about in a moment, but also because the three discussants, two of whom are ARC alums and one of whom is a prospective soon-to-be ARC alum, Maurice Krull, who is a distinguished professor at the Free University of Amsterdam and at Erasmus University in Rotterdam, is a former ARC fellow, as is Virginia Vivalian, a distinguished professor of psychology at Hunter College, and Vivian Louis, a professor of urban studies and Asian American studies at Hunter College, will be joining us in the spring. So I'm very pleased that this is an ARC event as well as an immigration seminar event. And with that, I will turn it over to Vivian Louie.
Thanks so much, Phil. Thanks to everyone for joining us today. It's so wonderful. It's a great, robust crowd. So I'm Vivian Louie, and I'm director of the Asian American Studies Program and Center, as Phil mentioned, and I'm professor of urban policy and planning at Hunter. And I'm so delighted to be leading today's book event to discuss Margaret Shin's book, Stuck. So along with ARC and the CUNY Graduate Center Immigration Seminar Series, the sponsors of today's book event are Hunter's Asian American Studies Center, Hunter's HCAP Project, and the Asian American Research Institute at CUNY, or ARI for short. Many thanks as well to Phil and to Van Tran for really helping to organize today's event. So Stuck, Why Asian Americans Don't Reach the Top of the Corporate Ladder is an important new book published by NYU Press. If you haven't gotten it yet, you should, and I'm sure you will. And we're joined here today by the author, Margaret Shin, professor of sociology at CUNY Hunter College and the Graduate Center. And this is Margaret's second book. She is the author of the award-winning Sewing Women, Immigrants, and the New York City Garment Industry, and a forthcoming book with Saeed Ali, tentatively titled The Peer Effect, Building Better Schools and Better Workplaces. I'm not going to say too much more by way of bio for Margaret, because you can all find her legs, I'm sure. I wanted to say that the plan is for Margaret Chan to speak for 10 minutes to set the stage for this terrific book about why she wrote Stuck and what's the basic research design, her important findings, and the responses so far. And then each of the panelists will speak for 5 minutes. And then Margaret will get about 15 minutes to respond. And then the panelists will also engage in further conversation. But we'll leave 30 minutes for Q&A. And I'll moderate today's proceedings. I'll keep time, and we're good to go. So Margaret, Professor Chan, please take it away.
Unmute yourself.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for introducing me. And let me go ahead and just start sharing a screen because I thought I would just highlight just a few points as I summarize, maybe a little bit easier. See if I got that. Can you see my screen? Are you good? Okay, great. Great. So first of all, I want to thank all of you again. Again, so Phil, Kay, and Don at ARC, Van and Nancy and Na and Dakota from the Immigration Seminar and the Hunter College Asian American Studies Program and Anna Pizzi and all the sociologists from the Grad Center, from Erica, Richard, Lynn, and no less all of the panelists, Vivian, Maurice, and Virginia. So why I wrote this book.
Margaret, I want to stop you one sec. I think you're showing us more than you want to show.
Oh, I do? Okay, let's stop the share.
You were showing us both.
Oh, my script? Okay. Yeah. Oh, here we go.
And as we all know, showing more than you want to is sometimes a problem with Zoom, ask Jeffrey Tobin.
Yes, it is.
Did we lose Margaret altogether?
I think we did. That's one way to get rid of sharing your screen.
I'm sure she'll be back in a few seconds. Thank you for your patience.
Neil, why do you
have a person
in the background?
Hi again, sorry. I don't know what happened there, but let's try it again. All right. One more time. Oh, all right. I can't share the screen right now, so I'll just go ahead and start talking. Okay. That's even easier.
You may need permission to share it.
Yeah. Oh, but I'll just go ahead and start talking. And
share now.
Well, I'll just go ahead and start, and then I'll start sharing it. There'll be important things later. So why I wrote the book. So way back in 2013, I was at a reception at the Harvard Club for newly admitted freshmen. So I myself am a Harvard alum, and I interview high school students. And at this reception, there were clearly many Asian American students who got in, and they brought their parents, their siblings, and other relatives to the reception. And half of the room looked like they were Asian American. And obviously the reception was a big deal for all these Asian American families. So an admissions officer there just casually asked me, you know, we've asked so many Asian Americans, or we've admitted so many Asian Americans since 1980. So how are they doing? Where are they? Why aren't they at the top? I don't see them. And then I thought to myself, you know what? I thought, you know, what happened to these second generation Asian Americans? Why am I not hearing more about them too? What are they doing? So that question got me thinking about the top in all areas. But one area struck me as relevant for Harvard graduates, and that was the C-suites. You know, so the C standing for chief, the senior executives, the team that made decisions. Given their significant academic achievements, why aren't more of them found at the top levels of the business and professional worlds? Is there a glass ceiling like that for women, invisible or a bamboo ceiling, a powerful barrier that halts their progress at a certain point? My findings show that there is a barrier for this population. It's not simply earning a college degree or landing an entry-level job, but it's moving into senior levels, into the C-suites. Mel Van Tran, Jennifer Lee, Tiffany Wong, and a bunch of other, Diana Pan, Richard Alba, and Victor Nee, and everyone in this panel have tried to address this question. And there are many others, too, who have worked in this. So some examples of this possible, some examples of these disparities. Let me see if I can show you the slide now. Can you see the slide now? Okay, so some examples of these possible disparities have to do with the Fortune 500. In the Fortune 500, there are less than a dozen CEOs who are Asian American. 3 are Black and 24 are women, and that's just late 2018. In Silicon Valley, there was a study done by Ascend, published in the Harvard Business Review, and where they found that in tech firms, 27% of them were professional levels of Asian Americans, 19% managers, and only 14% executives. In law firms, the Yale study by Judge Goodwin Liu, he found that Asian Americans had the highest attrition rates and the lowest ratio to partnership. In 1 year that he looked at, there were 124 Asian American associates, but only 14 made partners. 422 white associates and only 127 made partners. And if you look at Hispanics, 33 were associates, 5 made partner, 24 African American associates, and only 1 made partner. And of course, in the university, we know that the numbers are low too at the highest levels. CUNY just appointed its first 2 Asian American college presidents, Frank Wu at Queens College and S. David Wu at Baruch. In the fall of 2019, Queens College had 36% and Baruch 42% Asian American students. They only make up 2% of college presidents, which is far below Black and Latino college presidents at 8 and 4%. So looking at these numbers, that looks like there's a problem somewhere. And so I wanted to find out what happened. So to do this, I basically interviewed 103 people from Goldman Sachs, BlackRock, TIAA, all of these main firms with titles such as chief operating officer, general manager, directors, partners. In addition, everyone I interviewed had been evaluated with performance reviews. That is, they had a supervisor's evaluation of their professional performance. So in here, I talk about the broadly defined second generation. So let me tell you a little bit about that. So out of the 103 that I interviewed, they were all members of the 1.5 and second generation Asian Americans who graduated from college between 1980 and 2008. They're in their late 20s to late 50s. And I call them the broadly defined second generation because the 1.5 generation who arrived before the age of 13 are socially the same as the second generation. These are the people who have grown up in American schools, steeped in American culture, and speak English without an accent, are culturally indistinguishable from other Americans, and it is this group that parents have pinned their hopes upon. And this methodology was used by Phil Kasnitz and John Mollenkopf, Mary Waters, and Jennifer Holloway and their whole team in their research on inheriting the city. So I'm basically looking at that group, moreover, as like adults now. None of the people that I interviewed had any accent, and they thoroughly understood all of these U.S. cultural references. If you look at this chart, you'll see that these are Asian American, these are professionals. 40% of Asian Americans in this professional category are members of this broadly defined second generation. So if you're working in the professions, if you turn around and ask somebody, probably half of the people you talk to is this group. So why aren't they doing any better? So a little bit about the respondents, you'll see. They come from both coasts, Texas and Chicago. all earn well over $95,000 a year. Most of the people I interviewed worked in corporate America for over 20 years, and their experiences reveal a work world in which entree to the upper rung seemed impossible for many and filled with racial, gender, and class inequalities, inequities that complicate and even contradict the story of the model minority. So I use snowball sampling. I started out with my Harvard friends who from the alumni network, and I asked them to introduce me to other people who are like them, who are moving up in the work world. I have almost equal numbers of male and female, mostly East Asian though. And I, now that I realize it, I realize that a lot of South Asians don't fit this category. There are much fewer of them who are part of this broadly defined second generation. They're superbly credentialed, clearly leaders at work. And one interesting small finding is that only a quarter of them were first generation college students. Now to a couple of my main findings. Okay, we'll start here. I'll leave that there. So one of my findings was I coined the term the Asian American playbook, a term to label an almost universally used guide composed of verbal advice that Asian Americans use as they move through school and into the professional world. All of my interviewees mentioned this general playbook narrative. And of course, neither of them, whether they followed it or not, it's verbally transmitted, informal and practical how-to guide for Asian Americans designed to show them how to make it and be successful in both work and school in the United States. So specifically, it works in the United States. It probably won't work in Asia the same way. This general playbook says Asian Americans work hard, have access to opportunity, are able to be in control of their situations, choose what they want to do with their lives, and find rewards for themselves and their families. And this dovetails with the cheap-minded Asian American image or frame that the mainstream American public accepts as a generic story of Asian Americans. And of course, it reflects the aspirations that all immigrants have. The playbook narrative is important for Asian American parents because the goal is for the generation born and raised in America to be successful because their parents sacrificed so much, which is the immigrant bargain, as Vivian, Louis, and Rob Smith, both from CUNY, have written about. So Asian American parents raising children could have language difficulties, no time to parent because they work long hours, or even be engineer, scientist, professionals, but they may lack a network and information for how their kids should proceed. Parents and the second generation themselves share information with this playbook, which seems to help at least through getting a job. Interviewees said the advice is not detailed or nuanced enough to help them go higher. The advice doesn't address leadership skills, stretch assignments, networks, and more. So another finding I want to highlight is the importance of trust. And here's the quote from Sam. So at the highest levels, I interviewed seven people who've made it to the C-suites, and one of them is Sam, a South Asian. So I want to emphasize at this level that the person who is at this level needs to know how to use the key to keep the organization safe. When you're promoted to that C-suite, you're akin to giving a key to that person. As many of my high-level execs told me, at this high level, there are plenty of competent people to choose from. Remember all the young Asian American men who are extremely capable, who got through college, who got their jobs? Well, there are fewer of them whom executives feel they can trust. So I look back at why they all said trust, and I use the stereotype content model, by Susan Fiske, and of course, written about too by Amy Cuddy. And in Amy Cuddy's book, she says, we notice a person's competence only after we have judged their trustworthiness. When it comes to hiring and promoting people, corporate executives have plenty of competent people to choose from. So they only want those who are trustworthy. If a person is trustworthy, a friend, and competent, that person may be really useful in an organization. If a person is not trustworthy and a foe, and if competent, that person may be very dangerous. So why is this important for Asian Americans? It is that in addition to the successful model minority, hardworking, smart, dutiful stereotype, we are often seen as forever foreign. And that is from Mia Twan's 1999 book, Forever Foreigners or Honorary Whites. We're untrustworthy. And that may be the more influential stereotype that casts us as members of an outgroup, and it erases our humanity. Now, we have examples of this from COVID, you know, from this pandemic. We've seen it used a lot since. Of course, my interviewees were done, you know, all before this year, so they couldn't say that, but they gave other examples and they're in the book. So we're not seen as human, oftentimes like African Americans and Latinos. Okay, so now basically the response to the book has been pretty positive, and I found that a non-academic audience generally appreciates that I'm validating what they're feeling. And that's the biggest response so far, because I think there are parts of it where they may or agree or not agree, but it really it validates what a lot of them are feeling these days. So I will turn it back over to Vivian.
Hey there, can you all hear me? Sorry about that. I was having trouble unmuting myself. So that's fantastic, Margaret. Why don't we go, Maurice can kick us off and then Virginia can take it and then I'll close and then we'll have more discussion with Margaret. Does that sound okay?
It's perfect. Thank you, Vivian, and thank you for the invitation to say something about this very, very important book. I've had the privilege to hear Margaret present bits and pieces in lectures before, because we in Europe were doing a similar project on the upcoming elite among the second generation. So I knew what sort of data she was collecting, and also I was already a bit familiar with the arguments she was trying to make for the book. But this, I really have to stress it, has become a really impressive and ambitious book. And even more remarkable, it's still a very accessible book. This is really how a good academic book should look like. So congratulations, Margaret. It's really terrific. I say it's an impressive book, especially because of all the interdisciplinary work that has gone into it. The book, of course, has a strong sociological angle with the emphasis on power relations, but it also gives detailed insights in organizational structures, lending concepts from organizational science. It, of course, uses the anthropological method, and it enters the field of social psychology. Margaret already mentioned the work of Susan Fisker. And this makes the book so incredibly complete. If you read the book, you understand how the Bambi ceiling works from the individual perspective, at the major level of the community and the level of the organization where people work in, and on the political level of positive and negative stereotypes that are there in the wider society and on the work floor. We are still working on our own book with a group of European scholars, but I think they should first read your book before we write our theoretical and concluding chapter. So thank you for this book. So the idea of the playbook, and Margaret already mentioned that, forms a central red thread in the book. Margaret discusses how the playbook developed by Asian first generation parents and their children has been central in becoming successful in school and in college, and how there is need for a new playbook for moving from a junior professional level position to a middle and senior professional level position. That's where the people got stuck. When you read the book, did I already say that everybody should read the book and buy the book, by the way? Phil instructed us to say that. So you will notice that Margaret is actually writing the outlines of such a new playbook. And interestingly, and again, Margaret mentioned it, some of the mechanisms she describes are also very relevant for getting ahead in the academic world. I myself, for instance, finally understood why they never made me the head of the department or the dean, because they really do not trust a person like me to hold the key to the department or the faculty and to do any crazy stuff. I guess they do not fully trust me, and maybe they are right. But on a more serious note, our academic organization is really not that different. In my own organization, the Free University of Amsterdam, 15% of the students come from migrant families who themselves are born in the Netherlands. And I conducted a research into the diversity of our staff. Among the professors, only 1% belongs to this category. And there are simply no one represented from this category among the deans and the faculty chairs. So I really suggest a follow-up study on the academic world. Margaret shows that one of the centerpieces of such a new playbook should call attention to stereotypes about Asian Americans. The positive stereotypes about Asian Americans as hardworking and high performing has worked to get people into prestigious high schools and Ivy League colleges. But the negative stereotypes about Asian Americans being competitive and closed, for instance, on private matters on the work floor, hinders them to be trusted by the people in senior positions. Margaret comes basically with two main suggestions to overcome this. The first suggestion is very much in line with what we found in Europe among the upcoming elite in the second generation. People really need sponsors and mentors that open doors for them and make them understand and get to know the organization. The most successful people in our elite studies found these people. And Margaret suggests that positive action programs that were developed in the 90s should be brought back to life again. And I think the time is really also ripe for these sorts of programs politically again. Furthermore, in the new playbook, there should be an honest discussion about the existence of discrimination against Asian Americans rather than a denial. And people should exchange information how to tackle discrimination in your own organization. Since there's so much emphasis on individual achievements and hard work in the playbook for high schools and colleges, there's a lot of belief that you can overcome discrimination by working harder and being better than the rest. This emphasis on the individual ignores structural institutional racial barriers that are there. And I think the second generation Muslim upcoming elite in Europe is more realistic about these barriers. Maybe also because it's more in their face and hard to ignore. In the European case, people told us that they strategically chose when to act and respond to institutional racism. And when, because it will hurt, and when you should do that. Because it can also hurt your position in the company. And how they're quick to notice when there's a ceiling for them in the company and that it's time to move to another company organization to move ahead. So I have three short questions for Margaret, and you can choose more or less which one you want to answer. My first question is about how you think your respondents should act against racism. What should be written in the new playbook? The book is very complete, but on this question, the book has not given us a lot of clues. So we really like to invite you to say a bit more about it right now. And secondly, in the book, you gradually make a shift from more sociological explanations to more psychological explanations. And I was wondering whether your new book project, I don't know what the topic will be, would be more focusing on these psychological processes. And finally, you focus on one side of the interactions, namely on the Asian American employees, the people who aspire to get to the top. But given your conclusions, if you had to start a project again, would you have focused more on the other side, the Anglo-Saxon white people in the top that keeps the door closed? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Maurice. That was really wonderful, so thoughtful. Virginia?
Sure, I'm happy to go next. I first heard Margaret present some of her early material when we were both in the ARC program, and it's wonderful to see how it has developed into such an important book. What I want to highlight is the gendered aspect of the intersection between gender and ethnicity. I remember some time ago giving a talk to a company, and one of their more important people was Asian and not generation 1.5 or 2, but generation 1. And he had read my book, Why So Slow, The Advancement of Women, and he commented that he felt the situation of Asians in the industry workplace was very similar to what I was describing in Why So Slow as typical of women's experiences. Margaret talks about this in her book, and she talks about intersectionality, having more than one identity that complicates where one is with respect to how evaluations get made. So picking up a bit on the previous commentary, I want to focus on the employers and peers who are evaluating Asian Americans. Asian Americans, whether male or female, tend to be seen as technically competent, but feminized and somewhat weak. So that influences how they are perceived in the workplace. And Margaret has commented on this, that Asian Americans tend to be seen as technically competent, but not competent with respect to leadership. I think it is not just a question of warmth and of Asian Americans fitting that quadrant that Jews fit, for example. It is also that there is a perception of weakness about Asian Americans because they are feminized. That is, how they appear to other people is more feminized than is the case, for example, for African-American men and women or white men and women. So that has an influence on both how they are perceived with respect to their competence and how they're perceived with respect to their leadership abilities. In the book, Margaret talks about Ellen Powell, and I think she's a very good example of someone who couldn't do it right, not because of any flaw in her, but because of how evaluators were perceiving her. So comments that are made about Asian Americans are things like, you don't talk up on the one hand, and you're too aggressive on the other hand. So setting up a situation in which it's impossible to win. Similar comments are made about women. You should speak up more, but when they do, you're too aggressive. So things that are assertive in a man are seen as aggressive in a woman, or I would add an Asian American. So I think female Asian Americans are in a particularly difficult spot with respect to getting ahead. They are not seen as people who have the assertiveness and the leadership abilities. So Margaret has focused on trust, and I agree that that's important. I would add to that, there's the notion of who makes a good leader. And what we found in some of our research is that typically masculine traits are seen as what makes for a good leader, whereas typically feminine traits are seen as pluses, but no substitute for the other traits. When you're hyper feminine, as I think both male and female Asian Americans are perceived to be, it's a weakness. So you are not seen as having enough of the traits that you need to be a leader. And were you to adopt them, you would be seen very negatively because you're acting out of the role that the people who are in power see as appropriate. So I think that Asian Americans are in a very difficult situation, one that the playbook that Margaret describes does not help them with, and one that trust alone also does not help with. So I will stop there. I do have a couple of questions that I hope Margaret will address. One is that you look at Asian Americans very, very broadly, and we know that people see Indian Americans, for example, as different from East Asian Americans. And so I'm wondering what you think you might do to indicate the differences among those different identities. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much, Virginia. That was wonderful. And I just to build on what you've shared and what Maurice has already shared, I think that I did also as well see the similarities when it comes to gender, to a gendered narrative, but you framed it really brilliantly. So it's great. And I think Maurice's point as well, his question about the psychological processes, that is also very, very important. It brings me to the question of implicit bias, right? A key theme that's running through Margaret's great book, Stuck, is people like to promote other people who look like them. We like to reproduce ourselves, right? So I'm just curious. I mean, that is also where trust comes into play. But what I wanted to say, I wanted to start off by saying of why this group is so important. And to build off what Margaret had shared initially, that so much of the public attention and public framing, as well as the scholarly attention and scholarly framing, has been on Asian Americans and education. And in a previous talk that I think Maurice and Franz were there, I say that it's always so funny because I liken it to the Peter Pan analogy, right? Margaret's heard me say this, because it's like we're never allowed to grow up. We're never allowed. It's like we're always stuck in school somehow. And it's a funny thing because Margaret and I met in college. her sister and I were college roommates. But the key point here is that it's important to really have a holistic picture, right, of Asian Americans in education, but in other aspects of their lives. So kudos to you for writing this really amazing book and bringing that into view. But what you also bring into view is I think about 75% of your sample are folks of course, they're 1.5 and second gen, but they're basically the children of middle class parents. So parents who largely had professional jobs, college education, and also who were raised predominantly in white suburbia in the United States. So actually, from a social reproduction perspective, these are precisely the people that you would think would succeed, right? I mean, if they are having the educational credentials, they're being hired at these entry-level positions in large numbers, that's the group that you think would kind of rise to the top, if you will. And yet, something's happening along the lines of race, ethnicity, gender, nativity status. So my questions for you are, what one question is at the individual and internal level for the Asian Americans about not having a language, as you mentioned in the book, to even name discrimination or to respond to it. How can you respond to it if you can't name it? And what I was reading there, I was thinking that there's almost like this guilt factor, great because they saw their parents, even though their parents have college educations in the main and were middle class and had achieved a middle class status in the US, but they saw their parents struggling with whether it's not getting mortgages, being demeaned because of a language, the accent, all that sort of stuff, right? And so there's this expectation of like, how can I talk about my own experiences, right, with racial pushback? Because it seems so trifling by comparison to what my parents have experienced. So there's kind of a nativist boundary or immigrant boundary. That's one piece that needs to be, you know, unpacked for them. But then also there's this piece of how can I discuss my own experiences? Let's just take in the wake of the protest around the murder of George Floyd, our current moment. Right? So how can I even talk about what's happening or think about that as discrimination when we live in a world in which there's a very clear black-white boundary and binary? So where do Asian Americans fit in there, right? How can Asian Americans express voice within that framework? And then I also wanted to say, to personalize it as well, you know, a few of you in the audience might know this. I've worked in three different industries. I worked in daily newspaper journalism. That's where I started my career. I then worked in higher education, of course. And then I worked at a foundation, the William T. Grant Foundation, as a program officer for several years. And then I came back to higher education, to Hunter. And I'm thrilled to be here. And also thrilled to have the ARC Fellowship in the spring. But my question, or my thought actually, is that in all three industries, I have seen such a similar dynamic. And I'm an old person. I'm in the third chapter of my life. So just saying. So I've had a lot of time in which to see and process these things, right? So I read something recently saying that daily newspaper journalism is now in the United States realizing that it has a problem with systemic racism in its industry. And I remember reading that thinking, now? I was like, what about Rodney King? What about, you know, what okay, if you want to say now. But I also noticed in all three industries that there, you know, at least in the early 1990s, there was kind of a first stage of the employers, right, to build, because I really want to take us there, because I think that that is so important, the employer perspective, where it was like, well, we don't hire people of color. That wasn't even a term back then. We don't hire minorities, right? Because we can't find anyone who's qualified. And I remember back then, I didn't have, again, the language, but now I do, of course, which is, well, then you need to do a better job, right? When you go to conferences and you recruit people, don't just see your friends, right? You need to find other people, and they have, and that progress has been made. But then the second stage of what I noticed over time is folks saying, as Virginia was saying, you know, Asian Americans just don't want to be leaders. They self-select out. So they don't want it. They don't want to be promoted. I don't know. So my question to you is, you know, what do institutions need to do to create these opportunities for folks to speak up, to get to be known? Right. I think that was an opening quotation in one of your chapters. But also, these are corporations. These are workplaces. I'm not trying to portray my sociological roots here, but they're into the bottom line. Right. I mean, at least I think the companies that you've named, they want to make money. So what incentive do they have to promote someone, especially someone whom they don't really trust or know, or, you know, when they're getting so much labor and value out of them in a lower paid position, right? I mean, what's going to incentivize and motivate employers to do that, particularly if they feel that their bottom line will get negatively impacted, right? Because as you say, they can't promote everyone. Right, they have to make hard choices. And just a final point around that, about unpacking corporate America, is I remember at one point very early in my career, I had a mentor, and she said to me, this is in journalism, and we were talking about performance evaluations. And she said, but you know how performance evaluations work, don't you? Because she had been a manager and she stepped off for personal reasons. And I was like, what do you mean? She said, well, let's review your performance evaluation. And she said, you see, management is leaving a space. They're leaving a space. They're leaving a space for them to get at you later on when you're up for a higher promotion. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, you're right. But how would I have known that, right? How would I have known that? And I give her my kudos that she actually was so frank with me to say that. So I'll just stop there. Margaret, do you want to respond to our questions? Okay.
Okay. Yeah, sure. So I'm just trying to figure out where I should start with you or go back to Maurice. But thank you so much for all these great comments. That's really, really helpful for me to think about the book and to think about, you know, what further I should work on and what further I should even add in this new book that I'm working on with Syed Ali. So maybe to start, I'll talk a little bit about, I think Maurice asked the question, what's the next part of the playbook? Is that right? Right. So part of it is that I feel like there's tons of things missing from that playbook, right? And the playbook as it is kind of holds people back. And I think what's necessary is to look at how maybe institutions can play a bigger role. And that's the sociological part. I talked about trust, but I also think that institutions need to play a bigger role. Institutions need to implement some of these programs that are necessary, as Vivian mentioned. For example, you know, in my part of this is from the response I've been getting from people who are in the work world, right? So it may not be as sociological, but the parts of the playbook have to be more practical to people to move up. So part of it is Asian Americans, especially after this year, need to work with all the other minority groups to realize that they actually face racist behavior, right? And I think a lot of Asian Americans don't see that or have a very hard time seeing it, as Vivian has said, right? Because they don't have the language for seeing it, because they don't have a legacy of slavery. They don't have the legacy of the violence from the police. They don't have that legacy. But what they are feeling, you know, as Virginia even added, you know, the whole thing about being feminized or not seeing as leaders, all of these things actually don't reveal what all parts of an Asian American is as a human. And so I think that's part of it. And part of it is taking a stand with African Americans and Latinos to try to change things in an organization systemically. Now, that's the hard part, because it is the bottom line. But how do you convince people that that's the right thing to do, right? And so we're at a crux maybe that you could convince people that it's the right thing to do. And for Asian Americans, you know, we have seen how affirmative action programs implemented in 1965 for African Americans have actually benefited Asian Americans in college. So, and women too, women as well during the times. In 1965, 50%. Of college students were not female. So these programs actually help people in the long run. So people have to learn that people have to work together, at least to try to change these types of programs. And moreover, you know, the thing, the whole thing about the critical race theory and how we shouldn't be discussing these topics as we're discussing now on this Zoom, that has to change too. Some of these things have to be pushed back. So those are some of the institutional, and the playbook should have this chapter where people should not feel guilty, should not feel demeaned if they use these kinds of institutional programs. In fact, people should be encouraged. People should be encouraged to look for them and actually advocate with other groups for these kinds of programs. So more structure, more formalized programs would actually help a whole lot. And of course, for individuals, as all of you had said, there are certain things that people may need to learn, and people may have to take the hard road and try to discuss as an individual with others that, hey, that's not a behavior that I actually have, or that may be a stereotype. That's very hard. That's a very hard and difficult discussion to have, right? So that answers Maurice's question. There are others that I know you asked, but let me try to get to Virginia's question, which is, Indian Americans, right? So how do they fit or do they not fit? So that's a question I think lots of Asian Americans have been trying to understand. In the Asian American, I forgot the whole name now, the survey that Karthik does and Janelle does and Van Tran's even on it now and Jennifer Lee, it's the Asian American Pacific Islander National Survey. In that survey, they actually found that Indian Americans actually see themselves as Asian Americans, but East Asian Americans do not identify them as Asian Americans. So how do you bridge that difference? Part of it is also realizing that there may be differences and there may be similarities. Like all of our ethnic groups and racial groups, Asian American, the racial group, we don't even have a common language. For Latinos, at least, most people can at least have a heritage of speaking Spanish, right? But Asian Americans don't have any of that. So part of it is trying to see if there are any similarities and if not. And I actually think Indian Americans have a little bit of a difference. They have a heritage where some things benefit them and some things don't. For example, many of the immigrants that have come here, they have a heritage where they've actually come through, they were a colony of an English-speaking country. So when they come here, they may not have an English language difficulty. Their parents may already have English ability. Moreover, when I talk to some of them and their parents, they would mention their parents, even though their parents may not have attained a higher level job as they might have had in their home country, their accent, having an English accent, made a difference in how they were viewed. They were viewed with much more respect than somebody speaking with a Chinese accent or Korean accent. So those things actually may help. The other thing that may not help is that there's so many Indian Americans or South Asians in general, we're talking about them, they are Muslim. And I think in our country, we are beginning to see, or we have seen, right, that they face specific difficulties and biases. And I might call it even, akin to racist behavior, right? So I think that part of it has to be pulled apart. And I'm not quite sure if there's a sociological or psychological study that has pulled that completely apart yet, but there is some literature that I always share with my students by Mustafa Bayoumi, who is a Brooklyn College professor in English. Why am I up the problem? Addressing young people, and young people love that book. So that's one start to that answer. I don't have a full answer, but because I think they are seen as different, many of them support each other a lot more. Their networks are very, very strong. That I know. And then to Vivian's question. Oh no, now I blanked out. Vivian, you want to remind me?
Okay, so I think, I'm sorry, I'm monitoring the chat, so I have the questions for you from the audience too. So, question from me. So, what can corporate America do, right? Obviously, corporate America is not, again, I'm portraying my sociological roots, not necessarily there to promote the entire world. So, yeah.
Right, exactly. So part of what Sayeda and I are working on is looking at organizations. What is this peer effect we're looking at? And so we know that corporations know that when they have diverse members, diverse groups of people that get together, they're much more creative, much more sometimes intuitive. Sometimes like, people come at a problem at different angles and they get great answers. And so I think that's where it can be exploited. It can be exploited to the bottom line. The other thing that corporations need to do is that the the pipeline that you talked about, people aren't moving up in that pipeline. That pipeline has to be exploited. And part of the peer effect is that you work shoulder to shoulder with people who are different than you, but not just in the beginning level, but all throughout the level. So I have to remind you that, you know, when we all went to college, right, some of our college roommates were very, very different from us. They may be red, I may be blue, they may be very pro-life, I am, you know, pro-choice. But these are the things, and these college roommates of mine, and maybe yours, and other people, we're still friends after 30 years. And this is where we learn about these different issues. So that's part of the peer effect. And if you don't have that peer effect going up through the organization, you don't have that trust and you don't have all these other things, that creativity that also builds. So how can we convince an organization to have that peer effect? Part of it could be, and some organizations actually have this, they have incentives given to people to make sure their pipelines are broad. And that's the corporate boards, that could be the CEOs that are actually given direct responsibility to do this. And I have to mention something, Virginia here was one of my mentors. I was part of this NSF Advanced program. And Nancy Foner was my actual mentor who actually helped me get tenure at Hunter College. So 10 years ago, they deemed that there weren't enough social science and science women professors getting tenure. So what NSF did was they actually paid people to help read over my articles, help think about where I should place my articles, help look for funding. So these are things that actually help me get tenure. So these kinds of things do exist in corporations. Some of them bring people back. Some of them are actually promoting, but they're very rare. And the people I talked to who actually moved up, they had access to some of these programs. And that those were key because they gave them those things that we all mentioned, the network, the sponsors, the mentors, access to these stretch projects that gave them exposure to people. Those are just a few, you know, but I will stop here.
Okay, great. Virginia and Maurice, is it okay if I ask some of the questions that are in the chat, and then maybe you guys, you both can kind of close it off, because just to make sure that I get more questions. Okay, so that I can kind of keep it together here in my brain. Okay, so thanks so much again, Margaret. So Ani, the literature had a question about what do you think might be the gender similarities or differences in hiring and advancement throughout diverse labor sectors?
So what do I think are the gender differences or similarities in hiring through various labor sectors?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the question? Okay, yep. So different labor sectors, actually, you know, the whole idea about feminization is true. But different labor sectors actually have different ideas of how masculine they are and how feminine they are, okay? So they may have different views of how masculine they want their leaders to be or they may want less masculinity in their sectors, okay? So, you know, in take teaching, you know, where it's more female, or take, you know, these corporations, these law firms especially, are highly, highly, they're dominated by men, you know. And so I think that may also color or shape who they will promote and hire. Okay. So that's a quick way of answering that question.
Okay, great. And then I just wanted to put out one more question, and then maybe we can go back to Virginia and Maurice, and then I can toggle between. But this is from Sid. What can Asian Americans do when other people of color groups don't agree that Asian Americans share discriminatory experiences alongside them?
Yeah, so I think people need to start somewhere in explaining that, yes, there is anti-Black. I mean, this is all new language I learned this year. It's not in the book. There is anti-Black racism, but there's also anti-Asian racism, anti-Latino racism, right? So these are concepts that we've all learned in the United States. We've all grown up with them. So people of any color could have any of these racist behaviors. And so that's where I think you need to start with this idea that we can actually all have these behaviors. And so if they even can accept that, then I think you can convince some people to talk more or having these discussions more. And people will begin to see that, wait, some of these behaviors are actually quite awful, you know, and begin at that particular point. I mean, that's an easy, brief way of starting it, but I think that will be the most helpful part. You know, our books, our media, our newspapers, all of that stuff have examples. You can pull up any newspaper, you know, or any book, and you may be able to find examples of every single group in that article or in that newspaper in any one day, which is a shocker. But, you know, sometimes I feel like when I'm reading the newspaper, I can see this in one newspaper edition.
So. Okay. Great, Margaret. Maurice, do you want to respond or have an additional question? And then Virginia?
Yeah, I want to follow up a bit on the how to react to racism in the organization and make it a bit more complex maybe, because there's racism from colleagues, there's racism from clients, and there's racism from people above you. And this asks you to be very strategically how to react, because, I mean, especially racism from people above you can really hurt your position in the company. So I just want to ask what are the thoughts of Margaret about these different power relationships that are there?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Racism among colleagues, some people can just dismiss racists, or they feel comfortable in talking with them because it doesn't affect their job. But racism from people above, or even sexism from people above, can clearly affect whether you get promoted or whether you are blackmailed from that industry, right? And it's a real thing in these corporations. So anybody who's willing to sue a company, from what I gathered, they're willing to lose their job. And that is absolutely true from almost everybody I talk to. And I have this example of a woman in my book who was sexually harassed, you know, almost raped. And she complained, and there was nobody to defend her, not even other women, because they saw her, part of the stereotype of an Asian American woman is that she must be, you know, submissive or just wanted to have sex or whatever, right? And so it was completely dismissed. She had nobody who would speak up for her, even though they might have seen the same kind of incidents. But yeah, she clearly got her first promotion as promised. And then after that, when she left to find another job, she couldn't. And she's no longer in the finance industry. Mm-hmm. And this is pretty clear that this still happens in the finance industry. People are unwilling to speak up because, you know, these things do happen.
Virginia?
I want, again, to address the issue of evaluations. And when institutions think it's in their interest to diversify and when they don't. Most institutions care about the face they put forward to the world. So they want at least some token individuals who will appear to make it seem as if they're doing what they should be doing. But also most institutions are very resistant to change, including academia. So my colleague, Abigail Stewart at the University of Michigan, found that it took 10 years. They also had an NSF advanced program. It took them 10 years to change the percentages of women who were being hired in the sciences. In institutions like academia are at least in principle susceptible to moral arguments, but other institutions like finance and so on I think, are not so susceptible to those arguments. And so they want bottom line arguments. And you mentioned earlier, Margaret, that diverse teams are more innovative than non-diverse teams. And there is evidence to support that. My very jaundiced, cynical view of corporations is that they think they've got more than enough diversity to go around and that they can pick and choose who they want. And in a way, it's like the most prestigious colleges and universities in the country. I think they are the least interested in hiring people of color, particularly hiring people of color, because so many people want a job there. They can afford to be discriminatory, as economists like to talk about. So I think it's a really hard road ahead to try to get people to move from talking the talk to walking the walk, especially outside of academia, where people's positions are so fragile, as you mentioned. So within academia, positions are still fragile, but not quite as fragile as they are outside of academia. It's possible to organize together to change things in academia in a way that I think is very, very difficult in the for-profit world.
Yeah, can I add to that? So organizationally, what happens is in the executive world, it's not the chief executives who are responsible for this. They usually put this on a diversity officer, usually somebody who hasn't been there for a long, long time. And that individual oftentimes comes and goes all the time. So whatever programs that people feel comfortable with in discussing with this particular person, they oftentimes get shelved. Moreover, organizationally, I know that there are big pipeline problems, mostly because of the way we're structured now. People are not hiring from the very bottom and promoting up. As people move in from the outside, you know, because that people hire laterally now. And so how do people hire laterally? Through your friends. And when they hire laterally through your friends, you're looking for people like you.
Right.
Right. So there are fewer women, fewer people of color are coming up that way, even if you have a pipeline program, you know. So when we look at the structure of an organization, this is the kind of stuff that makes it extremely, extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to say something, and then I will go back to the chat and raise some questions in the chat. Sorry, it's like multitasking here. So I just wanted to, and I totally respect and value what Virginia has said. I just want to make sure, though, that we are also aware that higher education does have its own pipeline issues, and that we really need to make these issues kind of in your face, if you will, because otherwise people just don't do it. And I can speak from my personal perspective as a professional. Was the book resonated with me as well because of all these things about, oh, I didn't know about that opportunity, or, oh, no one took me out to lunch. No one had me over to their home. No one took me to the playground, right? Or met in the playground to just hang out with me. I mean, I'm just using real examples here until quite late in the game. And I realized, oh, and then it's kind of like, you feel churlish to say, I never said, I mean, it was not quite, even when I discovered all of this, that I was like, you feel kind of like weird, like saying to other people, why haven't I gotten an invitation? You know, but you know, as I say, third chapter of my life. So it's a different stage at which I'm at, but I also think that that's something that we need to push. And I don't wanna let higher ed institutions off the hook in terms of their undergraduates, and also in terms of the themes that we have in our heads. You know, I never went through I just decided not to do corporate recruiting. you know, so I know Margaret did, and that's great. It's not, it was never my thing. And so when it was time for me to graduate from college and think about a job, that's when I really realized, wow, what am I going to do? Right? I have this degree, but I have no networks. And career services was not set up for someone like me. And then I also wanted to say that, you know, in my own extended family, I think we have this impression, well, you went to Harvard or you went to whatever, you're set, right? They're going to take care of you. They're going to, and that's just not the way that institutions of higher education operate, I have found, and also from an insider perspective as well. But I think Phil has a great question. Okay, so Margaret, can you say more about the differences in different sectors? It doesn't surprise me traditional industries with lots of traditional gatekeepers routinely discriminate against people seen as outsiders. But I was surprised that we see so little advancement in new fields with fewer traditional gatekeepers like tech.
Thanks, Phil. That's a great question. And part of it is to understand how these new fields actually work. So they're what we call, a lot of these new fields are startups, right? So they could be in tech, they could be in anything, direct to consumers, you name them. You have a ton of little industries starting. They're actually, you know, entrepreneurs. They're like, sometimes they're even, you could even say they're young people, but they're actually building a mom and pop store is what they're really doing, right? So how can you maintain that? How can you hire an employee? How can you work all these hours? And we know that for even the new startup field, the reward, or you would get rewarded because you failed, you tried and you failed. So we know failing in these industries, I forgot the exact rate, but it's really high. Most people that do one of these things, have a startup, fail at high rates. So so that's part of the reason why people aren't making it. So if they're Asian American or they're Black or they're Latino or even women, sometimes they don't even make it to the first year to fail. They fail even before that. So part of it has to do with the funding. A lot of the VCs, when they look at funding, they're looking at funding sometimes their friends, sometimes organizations that they believe, that they just think will make it. They're not looking at the idea. They're looking at people who they think will be able to get more funds. And these are people who are usually not people of color and not women. So when you look at these tech companies that have succeeded, they're not by these people. It's not that they haven't tried. There are tons of people out there. And I think Victor Ni was trying to talk about this. I heard the beginning of his talk a couple times. They are actually all out there because many of them have actually left these traditional firms or may not even want to try because they know how difficult it is for them to actually move up. They actually want to be their own boss. And being their own boss, they want to build these startups. So trying to get into sometimes these competitions to get money, to even get themselves into the competition takes a lot of work and takes a lot of money. For some of these young people who may come from parents who may not have a lot of wealth in this country yet, or who may be second generation, it is difficult to have that money to fund their own startup. I myself have two kids who one in particular is in a startup. So I know from his experience and I know from his experience with and his friend's experience how difficult it is to start up and fail all the time. And the key thing here is getting that startup money to actually help. And that's why you see there are fewer gatekeepers, quote unquote. They're not people promoting them, but they're the people holding the bags of money.
Well said. So I'm going to ask a question again from the chat, which is about how stereotypes and also experiences with discrimination can vary by national origins. So someone has written, Elizabeth, I'm a little disturbed by the Southeast comparison to the East Asian. We might have been a British colony, so there might be a leg up in terms of language. I'm just paraphrasing. But we're left with the terrible legacy of colorism, which has been detrimental in this country and the one of our ancestors. So maybe you could say a little bit about that. And I think Virginia raised this earlier, but the broad Asian American category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, your question. I see it's Elizabeth in the chat, right?
Yeah.
The Southeast Asian comparison.
And then I think also Inga asked a question earlier about stereotypes varying by national origin, but I think you can put them together to make a nice question.
Okay. So I personally believe the Southeast Asians should be included in the Asian American category, mostly because I feel like a lot of the stereotypes about that playbook is actually verbalized in South Asian or Southeast Asian.
Maybe she means South Asian.
Yeah. In the South Asian experience as well. If you read Pawan Dhingra's book, Hypereducation, you will see that he actually talks a lot about the playbook. He doesn't call it the playbook, but that's what he kind of mentions and how important it is in the South Asian community and why they use it to move ahead in education. So I myself believe that we actually all share many commonalities. Now, each of the groups have different differences because we actually have different policies that allowed us into this country. So East Asians, we came with the family reunification law, and we also came with, during a time when they needed certain immigrants who could be in certain professions. Southeast Asians have also come because of war, right? So because of war, they have had a different relationship to American policies, where they might have been separated from their families, put into communities where there weren't many Asian Americans around them. They might also have less access to college. So there are differences among all of the different communities. And I don't mean to stereotype them, but I am saying that these are the stereotypes that do exist that other people may actually have of them. But as a whole, we are all Asian Americans and we share many, many similarities, at least in the way our parents, as children of immigrants, react to the way they think we ought to succeed in American society. A lot of times that is what people would say the playbook is also part of the meritocracy. And many times I would say the meritocracy doesn't work in the United States, but many of these groups actually believe in it. Why East Asians but not South Asians are underrepresented. Yeah, so that's a really interesting article by Jackson Liu. So yeah, people should take a look at it. And he talks about the networks among South Asians that are so important.
Okay, that's great. And then there was one question that was asked of both you and me, and if I could take moderator's privilege and answer it. And it was a question by Sharissa way up in the chat. And I'm just going to paraphrase it. But basically, she's asking, do you think that Asian Americans who do not speak accented English, right, make people, maybe let's just say employers, uncomfortable and receive a different kind of signal from folks? And I'm just going to go for it and I'll answer, because I've often thought about this. Because both you and I come from working class backgrounds, right? First generation college students, first generation professionals. And I have, you know, their chapter of my life. So I will just speak frankly and say that, oh yes, I feel that my life, I think people would be much more comfortable sometimes, people in authority. That was the question Sharissa was asking. If I had come from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and I don't mean this in a negative way. I've never actually even been to Cherry Hill, New Jersey, but I have a good friend who grew up there and was the son of a doctor and a scientist. That somehow there's just something in the back of people's heads, like, and on occasion it's been publicly voiced to me, how did you get here? Like, what's up with you? Right. So, but that's a different thing. But also there were two questions about and I'm mindful of time. We have 6 minutes. But I did want to ask, George is asking, how do we teach our kids to be leaders? And then a second person, forgive me, I don't have the name, but it's a related question. How can students develop their leadership and collaborative skill sets?
Yeah, so I would try to, avoid the playbook a little bit and let your children do what they want to do and encourage them that part of living in the United States is, you get rewarded for certain things in living in the United States. Teachers love good kids in class, right? And so that's why Asian Americans and Van Tran and Jennifer and all these people have written about how, Asian Americans are seen as the good kid, whether they are the good kid or not, but they're rewarded for that. But I would say push it a little bit and say that Asian American kids can do anything that they want. They don't have to be in those professions where our parents may have said, you have to be an engineer, a lawyer, a doctor, or forget about it. You're a loser. You don't want to be that. You don't want to be that parent. So you want to actually encourage them to do what they want to do. And I think part of it is teachers, they probably do see teachers rewarding other kids for speaking up, raising their hand. And that is where I think you should start with that. And I think, and part of it is that teachers have these stereotypes and they have to overcome it. Not all teachers do, but teachers may have it and have to understand that Asian American students don't have to fit into that stereotype either. I would also encourage kids to, encourage them to hang out with everybody, if possible, every other group. I mean, I think maybe Vivian, as an educator, do you want to answer, take a stab at this?
With the question about leadership and collaborative skills. And well, I think that, so is this my invitation from you to make a pitch for ethnic studies? Asian American studies, which of course I will fully take up. So, right, I think that we do need a lot more education at all stages of the educational pipeline, PK through 16, if you will, about ethnic studies and about how we're all in it together, but also how our histories do differ and the paradynamics do differ. And also within, just say, in the Asian American category, there are different dynamics for sure. But if you look at the history, broadly speaking, and I do teach it, you see that it's the sense of otherness, right, is so strong. I mean, it just plays out in different ways by group, but it is definitely there. And if you are interested in this, we have a terrific Asian American Studies Center event next Friday from 3:00 to 4:30 that Hunter is sponsoring on Asian American student voices in the wake of COVID-19. But I wanted to, Maurice and Virginia have kind of a final reflections to then bring to you, and then you can have the closing word because we have 3 minutes.
I'd like to add that although we want to give people the skills and knowledge that they need to maximize their potential, we have to focus on how institutions work and change those institutions. The problem is not the individual Asian or African American or white woman. The problem is how institutions respond to them. And that's where we need to focus.
I would just only say, hear, hear. That's exactly what I would say. I think, that was also partly my third question. I mean, we talk a lot about how the Asian Americans should act and what they should do. But basically, it's on the other side, the employers that keep the door closed, and that's the institutions.
Yeah, absolutely. I just have to echo that as well. I definitely.
Do you have any kind of closing thoughts, Margaret, that you want to leave us with in the wake of this amazing book discussion that we've had and the really thoughtful comments and questions by Maurice and by Virginia, but also all the folks who raised these terrific questions in our chat?
Oh, I just say a big thank you to all of you. I really, you know, take your comments to heart, and I think they're absolutely perfect. And I'm excited. I'm so glad we had this chance to do this, to have this great conversation. And hopefully we can change institutions, you know. That's what I really hope we do. Thank you so much.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And again, you should, just terrible, you should just get the book. It's really wonderful. It's a great read. And thank you so much for attending. And thanks to everyone and to all our great sponsors. And thank you so much. Thank you, Phil and Van, Margaret, Maurice, Virginia. Yes. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank
you. Also, thank you, Vivian.
Okay.
I just put the code in the chat. It's chin30-fm for NYU Press. You get 30% off. And I think free postage too.
So, Van, I did have a question for you. Someone asked if the slides would be shared. Actually, it's for Van and for Margaret. So maybe we can touch base offline, see if that could be the case. And also the link to the recording, because someone couldn't attend, I think, yeah.
And we can send the materials to everyone who registered to attend today. We have the entire email list, so everyone will get the materials.
So they'll get the slides and the recording?
Yes.
Okay, fantastic. Okay, great. So then I can share. Okay. Thank you so much. Take care, everyone. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.